tonight we are moving at the speed of a mighty tortoise into Genesis 25, and we're going to span another generation tonight. We're going to jump ahead all the way to see the birth of Esau and Jacob, and then what Moses does is he kind of circles you back, gives you a little bit more about Isaac's life, although as we said, Isaac doesn't get a lot of play in the story. He's really kind of a transitional figure. So there's more to come by far concerning Jacob and his household, certainly than Isaac. But we do need to dig into the story tonight, and Moses is going to wrap up for us the life story we'll see of Abraham. And I'm going to start reading in verse 1 of Genesis 25. It says, Abraham again took a wife, and her name was Keturah. Now, how many of you did not know that Abraham had another wife before he started studying Genesis, right? And she bore him a whole bunch of sons. She bore him Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. We don't run into a lot of Ishbaks on the street nowadays, but Jokshan begat Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Asherim, Letushim, and Leumim. Those are actually not names of people. Those are people groups. When you have that I-M ending in Hebrew, it's a plural, usually masculine plural, so it means that you've got groups of people there. And the sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanok, Abida, and Eldaa. All these were the children of Keturah. And Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had. And while he was still living, he sent them eastward away from Isaac his son to the country of the east. So a lot of people don't know that Abraham had another wife besides Sarah, because the Bible doesn't say a lot about her. Somebody who had apparently a somewhat lengthy and more fertile marriage with him. So, but naturally, people are curious about Keturah and these other people once they learn about her. So what can we know about her and about them? First, it's not really completely clear when this marriage took place. It seems that it probably happened after the death of Sarah, you know, likely out of a need for companionship. You notice that Moses says Abraham again took a wife. So we were talking about how Sarah was 127 when she died, and at that time Abraham was 137. She was 10 years older. He was 10 years older than she was. Isaac was 37 at that time, and then 3 years later he got married. So I think that this is a likely time for him to contract this marriage once Isaac has settled down. Last week, you know, Abraham was worried about Isaac getting settled, getting established, because Abraham could say, well, it looks like I'm kind of coming to the end of the line here. You know, I'm pushing 140 and so on. So
that's the new 130.
Yeah, 140 is the new 130. Little did he know he had 35 more years to go on top of that. But, you know, ladies, how would you like to be have your arranged marriage almost all finalized and find out that, you know, dad is marrying you off to a man who's 140 years old? So, but we have no information whatsoever about her background. We think that her name means something like incense, right, that you burn. So this is actually kind of a hint to her destiny, if you will, because her sons that would go on to live in the parts of the world over there in Arabia where they trade spice and where a lot of these spices come from. So interesting. What was her status in the family? Well, this is the subject of a lot of debate over the years. Moses refers to her as a wife, but later on in the Bible, she's referenced as a concubine. So I think what's happening here is that she is a wife with a lesser status than Sarah had, and we had talked about that in the past. She is a wife whose sons will not be able to compete with Isaac for status in the family because, you know, Isaac was the son of promise, right? And probably not be able to compete with Ishmael either, because Ishmael, you recall, was also blessed by God. So maybe she's just the most significant woman still in the household, the the chief, this is crazy to say, but the chief concubine, if you will, right? Someone's got to fill that position, I guess. The most important, but seriously, this, you know, we laugh at that because our society is not structured this way. But when you read about how many rivalries and envyings and jealousies there were in all these families, you can see why, right? Because somebody was, you know, at the top of the pecking order. So if Abraham had several other concubines, it does say concubines there, so we don't know. I mean, were there five or six, you know, other concubines that he had? And maybe what Moses is telling us is that Keturah was the favorite, and she had the children who were the most significant. So it's a very odd thing, but that's, you know, how they did things. So we will see in a minute that the sons of Keturah are handled differently, right, in terms of their inheritance. So one question that always comes up when this story is mentioned is about the fertility of Abraham. What happened? I thought Abraham was, they said, was just about as good as dead, at least in respect of procreation. So how is he so fertile? Starting at the age of 140 or so, he produces six more sons. And the commentators usually suggest that this is a continuation of the supernatural thing that God had done in him, that Abraham and Sarah were supernaturally rejuvenated so that Sarah could conceive Isaac. And so Abraham's body apparently was rejuvenated enough by his faith that now he you know, was in a second youth, as it were, with respect to fertility. So, because you'll remember that the Bible specifically tells us that, you know, by the age of 100, his body was as good as dead when he fathered Isaac. And that was the point, the rub of his faith, right? So, all right, well, who are these sons of Keturah? A lot of them are hard to trace, but surprisingly, we do know quite a bit about these people and where they went. There were many towns actually in Arabia that carry the names of some of these people, which is really fascinating because you think that these people, we're talking about something that happened literally 4,000 years ago. So, you know, that people would remember and say, well, that was the territory of this person or that was the village where this man lived. So the most notable of them, I think you probably know, is Midian, who was the father of the Midianites that we see again and again in the Old Testament. They remained in this region until the time of Moses and even beyond. So obviously they were close relatives of the Israelites. And Moses, if you remember, Moses, actually his first wife was the daughter of the priest of Midian. You've all seen the Ten Commandments, so you know how that started at the well. We won't get to Exodus until 2026, so, you know. Now, some of the Midianites might actually have worshipped Abraham's God, not as Yahweh in the fullness of knowing him, but as El. We talked about this concept in the past that El was the general name in the area for the Creator God. The God that was above everything. So many of these people worshipped El as the creator, but that doesn't mean that they didn't worship other gods as well. And I think the Midianites were in this category, ultimately. They kept some of what they knew about the God, the creator, the one true God, but then they brought these other gods in. And so you read as you go through the Bible that the Midianites helped to bring the Israelites into idolatry and to commit sin, to practice fornication. In fact, the Midianites are usually not viewed in a very favorable light ever. There are a couple of exceptions. Moses' father-in-law was Jethro, the man who gave him that wise advice, and he was the priest of Midian. So he had some relationship with God. Didn't know him as well as Abraham did, but knew him enough probably to pray to him and make sacrifice to him, kind of like Melchizedek, right? And then, of course, Moses' wife, Zipporah, or Zipporah. So when you watch about the news in Israel and they have people or politician, there's one politician, her name is Zippy. And that means her name is Zipporah. So you see the negative side of the Midianites rather quickly. a few chapters down, because they are the ones who act as the middlemen, and they sell Joseph down into Egypt. So that's interesting. Egypt, at that time, Israel made war with Midian when they were coming out of Egypt in the time of Moses. And all the way down, centuries later, in the time of the judges, the Midianites were still oppressing the Israelites, still ruling over them from time to time. And that was the story of Gideon. You remember the story of Gideon? That's who Gideon was raised up to deliver Israel from, was the Midianites. So a thorn in the side of Israel, right, for centuries to come. 1,000 years after this happened, or 800 years or so, the Midianites are still bothering their cousins, the Israelites. Midian seems to have given his name also to an entire region south of Israel in Arabia by the Red Sea. And there's a little map there. I love those old maps. So you can see where the land of Midian is. If you can't find it, there's actually a big arrow that points to it. Right? Not that you all wouldn't have found it. But, it's actually very possible that Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments, is actually located in the land of Midian. It is not in the Sinai Peninsula. Paul even talks about that in the letter to the Galatians. He talks about Mount Sinai, he says, in Arabia. So, some of these places may not actually be where we think they are. In fact, this map shows Mount Sinai as being down in the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, but I don't think it was there at all. I think it was located in what we now call Saudi Arabia. There's a mountain there in Saudi Arabia that in Arabic they call the Mountain of Moses. And so a lot of people think that that's actually where that happened. All right, the other notable people in this list as sons of Keturah are Sheba and Dedan, and those are names that come up again and again in the scriptures. So, all right, so where did these sons of Keturah go? Moses tells us that Abraham, very wisely, Abraham was careful to send these men away. He says he gave Isaac everything he had, but he gave gifts to these other children. Right? So Isaac got the big inheritance, but Abraham had a few bank accounts there. And he says, I have a bank account for you, Jokshan, and a bank account for you, Midian, and so forth. So no doubt that these were substantial gifts, and they were enough to pacify them. And if you're thinking along with Abraham here, his motivation is what? His motivation is to make sure that Isaac, the son of promise, does not have any rivals nearby who are going to cast a jealous eye in his possessions. And so Abraham sent them away toward the east. And when we study these names out in detail, which we can't do here, it would be really unnecessary to get bogged down like that. Most of these people, as I said, went into what we think of as Arabia today. And so you could see that already within a couple of hundred years, God's word is really going to be completely fulfilled to Abraham, because God had said what? Changed his name and said, you will be a father of many nations. And that started to come to pass very quickly. And if you're interested in who all these people are and where they went, you can look that up in some of the more advanced Bible commentaries, and people know where these people went for the most part. So, all right, moving on to verse 7. I think I'm dehydrated tonight or something. Verse 7 says, this is the sum of the years of Abraham's life which he lived, 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. So we read that story a couple of chapters back, how Abraham, if you weren't with us, purchased that plot of ground that contained a burial cave that is still revered today as the burial place of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and so on. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt at Beer Lahai Roy. So, all right, it's sad to say goodbye to Abraham. He's been the principal character here since chapter 12. And now he's passing from the scene. But Moses is doing something interesting here for the sake of storytelling. He's giving you this episode out of order. So this is out of chronological order. He placed this story here because we're going to now focus on the life of Isaac and then Isaac's two sons. But in reality, Abraham lived to see his grandchildren. Abraham lived to be 175, and that means that he wandered for 100 years, an entire century, in the land of promise without a permanent dwelling. Some of you think you're stuck in a dead-end job. You've not yet wandered 100 years around and around making, tracing your steps in the same place, all right? Well, hopefully that didn't come out on the tape, but... You can all compare notes about, you know, bad jobs later. I won't say who it was, though. It's hard to know precisely when this happened. The scholars debate. They try to match up the customs, how they date these things. They try to match these customs that we've read about with what they know is going on in the area at the time. Archaeologically, and match it up against different kings and different references that are there. So scholars will debate maybe 100 years one way or the other, but probably, when did Abraham die? Probably about 1900 BC. So he was probably born about 2050 BC and probably died around 1900 BC. So we can move the needle, you know, a generation or so in either direction. We just don't know. But Moses tells us that Abraham died in a good old age and full of years. Now, I think the English Bibles make a mess of this because that is not at all what Moses was saying. The Hebrew does not say full of years. It just says he was full when he died. When he died, he was full. And the word means that he was contented. It means he was satisfied with his situation. He could look back on life and he was content with what God had brought him to and how things ended up for him and his family. And I want to suggest, you know, Abraham is the father of our faith. And I would like to suggest to you that this is the final demonstration of Abraham's faith that we see in the Bible. Because he died trusting in the providence of God. He looked back at his life and he said, I'm content. I am satisfied. He died placing the future of his family in. Really, he didn't really understand it the way that we do looking back, but it was really the future of the world that hung on him and on his posterity, and he was content to place that in the hands of the God that he served. So, you know, with his age and the wisdom that he must have had, he could probably already see the trouble that was coming because of the lives of his grandchildren and how they were growing up, these two teenage grandsons he had that we're about to meet. But see, he had faith because he trusted that because of God's promises, God was going to shape those young men for his purposes, and God was going to cause all of his other covenant promises to come to pass down the line. And that's a great lessons, so many good lessons there for us, right? In a world where we know our lives and the lives of people around us, our family members and so forth, we know that all of our lives contain very obvious imperfections. That there are things, there are situations in our lives that are not all fixed up, that are not really great. But see, Abraham could die and say, you know what? That is God's worry. He's been faithful to me. And I have to die in faith believing that he's going to be faithful to them. And he's going to cause all things to work together for good for them. So I can leave this life not worrying, but full, content, satisfied, because it's in the hands of Yahweh, my God. Then Moses says that Abraham was gathered to his people. That's a great phrase. And that's the first time we see this phrase or a similar phrase in the Bible. Many times as you read through the stories of the kings, it says somebody will die and they'll say he was gathered to his fathers, right? So what this means is that he had gone and joined his ancestors in the underworld, in the realm of the dead, where the dead were believed to reside. So in Hebrew thinking, I think some of you will know that all of the dead were believed to go into the underworld, which they called Sheol. Now this creates a lot of confusion for us all the time in English, because English Bibles usually translate this as by our word hell, which is a problem, because when that word Sheol is used, it does not necessarily imply that the person is, you know, in torment or in flames or something. So it simply means that they descended to the place of the dead. And every person who died was considered to descend into the place of the dead. And the righteous enjoyed rest and peace and protection, and the wicked were in torment. So Jesus talked about this. He explained this concept when he told the story of the beggar named Lazarus and the rich man who wouldn't help him. And so Jesus said that the poor beggar was, he died and he was carried by the angels to where? He said to Abraham's bosom, and he was resting with Abraham. And so when Jesus died and rose again, Jesus emptied that compartment, so to speak. In Ephesians chapter 4, the Bible says, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive. So that compartment is empty now. The wicked dead are still there in their torment. But now, as a believer, because of what Jesus did, when you die, the Bible says, what? To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, right? Jesus said, this day you will be with me in paradise. He didn't say, when you die, you're going to have to hang around and wait a long time till I come down and get you, right? But the patience of those saints was that God would rescue them. It's a great mystery, but you know, in some of the traditional church backgrounds that some of you might have, you might have heard some of the old creeds and so forth talking about Jesus, and says he descended into hell, right? Have you heard that expression? But that's what it means. It doesn't mean that Jesus went to hell in the sense that we use it in our culture, that you're going to be tormented in flame or something, you know, God forbid. So in the Psalms, David had prophesied about the Messiah, saying, you will not leave my soul in hell, but it's you will not leave my soul in Sheol. So when Jesus died, he descended into this underworld and he brought the righteous out. So, but they had that conception then that when you die, you went and you were gathered to your people. So Abraham, when he died, you know, when you die, you remain conscious. And so Abraham became conscious that he was there in this place with his righteous ancestors before him. Very interesting. But there we have the burial of Abraham, and we see who's there. The two sons of divine blessing, Isaac and Ishmael, are coming together and burying him in the family burial plot and burial cave. And then God tells us through Moses that God blesses Isaac. That's interesting because it doesn't say Yahweh. We're not really sure because of that. Is he really talking about Abraham's covenant, or is he talking about something else? See, Isaac was already the heir of the blessing of God. Get this with me. But I think that Moses is telling us that God was blessing Isaac in a very obvious way. Why? So that people around could see that the blessing had come to him, that he was blessed just as Abraham had been blessed before him. You remember when Abraham was alive, and the older he got, he was more blessed, he had greater status, and people were like, spoke about him, the pagans, people said, oh my Lord, you are a mighty prince among us. And I think God did that to demonstrate his blessing, to demonstrate that Isaac now was the one who had the promise, right? How many of you know there's a verse sometimes we quote when we're taking an offering? Moses said, remember the Lord your God. He is the one who gives you the power to create or increase wealth. And in so doing, God confirms his covenant. So what was happening there was God was like pouring blessing on Isaac so that all these other Hittites and other ites in the area could get the picture that, okay, Abraham has died and now his son Isaac has this supernatural blessing on his life. So, and then we get this detail from him about him that he was dwelling again at the well of Hagar that we've talked about, which was called the well of the living one who sees me. And remember, there's so much about Isaac's life that's connected with wells, the wells that he went to and what they mean and how he had to return to the good wells. So this is a hint to us again that the blessing of Isaac comes to us from being aware of God's presence, from seeking God's presence, and from trusting in his providence. Why? Because God is providing for me. He sees me. He's the living one who sees me. And so remember, none of these details are ever for nothing that Moses gives us. So when he says he was living there, when you read something like that, find out what that means. It means something very important in this case. All right, so now we're going to dig a little bit into Ishmael and a little bit about Isaac's background, a recap, and then we are going to meet the twins. How many of you have twins? Anybody have twins besides me? No, it's unusual because in our church, there's like tons of sets of twins, right? So he says in verse 12, this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. And these were the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names, according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael was Nebayoth, then Kedar, Adbeel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadar, Tema, Jitter, Naphish, and Kedema. These were the sons of Ishmael, and these were their names by their towns and their settlements, 12 princes according to their nations. So they had 12, just like there were 12 further down in the generations of Jacob, right? So these were the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And they dwelt from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go toward Assyria. He died in the presence of all his brethren. This is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah's wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. And by the way, just in case you think that people in this country were not Bible readers, there's an important road where I live called Paddan Aram Road in the city I live in. So don't ever tell me that people didn't read the Bible in those days, you know. Most people think it's something from the Indians, you know. But it's not. So we have this small section here in which the generation or generations of these men are discussed. And you see this several places we've seen in Genesis. And these references to the generations of different people are like the internal chapter divisions of Genesis. Okay? So you know that the chapters that we have, we're in chapter 25. And you know that those are very artificial divisions that people created in the Middle Ages for the ease of use, and the verse numbers also. Hope you know that. If you didn't, you know it now. So, right, Moses didn't say chapter 26, right? But what he did do was he used this device. These are really like the chapter divisions. The Hebrew word is toledot, which means generations. And there are 10 of these sections in the book of Genesis, using that Hebrew word toledoth. Now, these are not really, there's no way to really describe what this is in English. It's not a genealogy or a history. It's really a generational turning point is the idea of it. Moses is showing us every time he says this, right? These are the generations of Noah. These are the generations of Shem and so forth. Moses is not interested in showing us genealogies. He is interested in showing us every time that things diverge. Every time that there is a new beginning, that's when you get a separate entry for a different generation, right? You may remember that there is no place where it says, these are the toledot, these are the generations of Abraham. Did you notice it doesn't say that? I mean, there's probably not really anybody more important in Genesis than Abraham, but it doesn't say anywhere, these are the generations of Abraham. Why? Because it does it one level further up. Because one level further up is where there was an important branching off. His father was Terah, right? And Moses says, these are the generations of Terah. Why? Because that's where there was a separation and a division. So every time there's an important separation, where God's people move off to one stream and other people break away from them, you see those breakaway points. Does that make sense? So Here, Ishmael and Isaac are going their own ways. They're building their own civilizations, if you will, after the death of their father. And Moses refers to each of these two men as the son of Abraham, which is emphasizing to us that these two men only had divine promises of blessing, and the sons of Keturah and the concubines did not. Ishmael dies very old. He leaves 12 sons behind him, and he dies in the presence of all his brothers, which is exactly, he lived in their presence, which is exactly what had been prophesied about him when he was born back in chapter 16. In other words, Ishmael did not have a territory per se, but he lived here and there, kind of sprinkled around all the other people that were there. And it's the same today. Many of their descendants, millennia later, are the Bedouins, who are not, don't have their own territory, but they live all over the place. They're in Morocco, they're in Libya, they're in Egypt, the Sinai, they're in Israel. So that's a direct fulfillment of prophecy from the Word of God. That's the actual word that the angel spoke to Hagar when she thought she and the baby were going to die out there. Amazing. So, and Moses tells us that Isaac was 40. We also see for the first time the word Syrian, which is extremely confusing in your Bibles, because it's not the word Syria at all. It means that he's an Aramean. So some Bibles have that word Syrian, which has caused tons of confusion, because today we have a country called Syria, which is something completely different. So the land of Aram is something that included, you know, what we call Mesopotamia or Iraq at that time. So when it says Syria, don't think of Syria that you hear about on the news. Just that general part of the world that includes Syria and Iraq. All right, now we're actually going to move into a bit of Isaac's story. And as I say, there's not much of it. So in verse 21, it says, "Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If all is well, why am I like this?' So she went to inquire of the Lord." So this is the picture that Moses is painting for us of domestic life in the tents of Isaac. And we see that he is a very different spiritual temperament, as we said before. Very different from his father Abraham, right? Remember how Abraham and Sarah responded to this very same issue of barrenness, right? By scheming, by trying to help God out. But Isaac is of a different character because he grew up in God's presence. And so how does Isaac respond to a difficult family situation? He responds by praying. He responds by seeking God. And in time, God answered his prayers. But there was difficulty, as you see, and this is a foreshadowing of the tremendous conflict that's going to follow. Moses says, children. And so Moses, and we know that Rebekah is going to have twins, at least, even if she didn't know that yet. But Rebekah could feel this war going on in her body, and she was disturbed by it. So he doesn't really tell us what he means when he says she went to inquire of the Lord. Usually when they use that language in the Bible, it means that they went to find a prophetic person who could give them an answer, that they would go, you know, in the later years of Israel, you say, "I'm going to inquire of the Lord." It meant that they were going to go find a prophet or find a priest who could give them an answer from the Lord. But it's confusing because at this time, the priest of the people was usually the father, was the head of the family. So we just don't know. But that using that phrase seems to indicate that she went to somebody like a prophet to try to figure out what was happening. "And the Lord said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger.'" So verse 24, "When her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. And so they called his name Esau," which means hairy, and not short for Harold. "Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, So this is a very quick family history here, right? We're moving. Moses, when he wants to, can move a little faster than me. But so the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, a placid man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So I want you to notice that Isaac's spiritual character, for whatever reason, during this time period, had started to decline. Because this is not a good reason to play favorites with your kids, right? Yeah. He brings home, he swings by McDonald's for me or Chick-fil-A on the way home. So he's my favorite. And a high level of spirituality is not indicated by this passage. But we see that the Lord spoke to Rebekah either directly through a prophet, however it happened, and he uncovered the mystery. And this conflict, as I said, was really a prefiguring of what was to come. There were going to be two nations, and the older would serve the younger. So when the twins were born, Moses said the first one is red. And that's not a bad thing. There's nothing negative about him saying that. That simply is a reference to his coloration, that he was what they used to call ruddy. Maybe he had reddish hair. And you know there are people in the Middle East, Jewish people, Arab people, that have reddish hair. We know that David, King David, is described like this as being a red person. So what's interesting and unfortunate is that he was so hairy that he was called Esau, which means he was hairy. And the idea here that Moses is painting for you, and I'm not saying he made it up to tell the story, but he wants you to see the contrast between, somebody said it like this, Moses is showing you two people, the wild and the mild, right? So Jacob now, on the other hand, his name is Yaakov, and that is related to the word, the name for the heel of your foot, because he was grabbing his brother's foot on the way out. So in this context, although it depends on how they write the vowels and so forth, but in this context, it means that he is grabbing the heel. That's not a great name, heel grabber. It's not a good name to give your kids. So you're like, Rebekah must have had a really lousy labor. Name these kids Harry and heel grabber. It's not good, right? So that name, in a figurative sense, what it means is that he is deceiving somebody, or he is supplanting somebody. Now, supplanting is an old-fashioned word we don't use much in 2016, but supplanting means that you are taking what rightfully belongs to somebody else by tricking them or by treachery. And of course, that is completely prophetic in Jacob's case. He's the supplanter. He's the heel catcher. But there's also a positive aspect to this name. Jacob is a common name, so I don't want anybody in the room to go home worrying that their son or their grandson is named heel catcher. So Jacob was actually, the archaeologists tell us that Jacob was actually a well-known name at this time in Mesopotamia. So maybe she said, well, that's cute, because if that's his name, I'm going to name him Jacob, because we had an old uncle Jacob back in Mesopotamia. So it was a common name, and it may mean that, what the name may mean is that El, or God, has protected him. Or they say it could be a prayer that means, may God protect him. What does that have to do with your heel? What is protection? Well, because it speaks of the idea that somebody powerful that is right on your heels protecting you. That God, El, is walking right behind you. And that really makes it a wonderful name to have, actually. But in this particular case, Moses is definitely telling us that he was called heel grabber because he was grabbing his brother's heel. And we find out that Isaac is 60 when this happens. So that, do the math, tells us that Rebekah has been struggling with barrenness for as much as 20 years. That's quite a trial, right? And this also means, do the math again, that Abraham was still alive. I told you that Moses wrote this out of order for purposes of his narrative. And then Abraham was 160 when this happened. And so Abraham lived to see these two boys become 15-year-olds. And you see, Moses wants you to know that they have these different temperaments. Jacob was quiet, and he was very content to follow the family, the pastoral lifestyle, not pastor in a pulpit, but living in pastures with your animals and living in your tents. But Esau was an outdoorsman and a good one at that. And, you know, the family played favorites, like I said. And favoritism would really come back to bite this family in the next generation. So we wrap it up with this well-known story, verse 29. Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew, or literally it's just red stuff, or red, what he said. So he kind of came in just like slangy Hebrew, said, give me some of that red you got going over there, because I'm weary. And therefore his name was called Edom, which means red. And that is still the word for red in Hebrew today in Israel. You know, they don't have the red cross. They have the red Edom shield of David. It's the Magen David Edom, the red shield of David is the red cross in Israel. So it's interesting when you find that you could go 4,000 years into the future to today and people could still understand and still are using the exact same speech that they were using 4,000 years ago. It's amazing. But I don't know where that came from, but... But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. So if you want this pot of red meat, it's going to cost you something. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. So what is this birthright to me? And then Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Most expensive cup of Goya frijoles ever. And then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. And thus, or by this means, or in this way, Esau despised his birthright. Now this is really, despite how short this story is, this is one of the pivotal stories in the entire book of Genesis, even though it's just a few verses. And in this are revealed the character of these two people who, to be honest, both of these people are pretty disreputable. Right? Esau, he's hot-blooded, he's rash, he's melodramatic, oh, I'm going to die, right? He's not concerned with the future, he's not concerned with spiritual things. He only wanted to satisfy his immediate sensual desires, and he exaggerated his situation so that he could satisfy himself. And in the Jewish conception of things, Esau has always been a picture of the sensual Gentile world that is driven by the lusts of the flesh. And they're exactly right. He picked up a new name here. He became the father of the nation known as the Edomites. And the Edomites were enemies of Israel down through history. We'll say more about them on another night when we have more time. And if you haven't noticed yet, over time, I'm trying to give you a little understanding as we march through the book of who all these brother and cousin nations are. Because as you go through the Bible, you're going to see these same nations and their descendants popping up all the time. So that's the character of Esau. It's lousy. And by contrast with Esau or Edom, Jacob, on the other hand, is a grasping and conniving individual who is always, I'm not being funny, right? Who is always ready to take advantage, quick, always ready to take advantage of people and situations. And we could say that this was really the ultimate situation to take advantage of. Well, what was the birthright? It's hard to know exactly everything that was contained in it, in this story, but the birthright probably, at a minimum, it represented the main share of the inheritance. So later on in the history of Israel, under the law of Moses, the eldest son typically got twice the share of what the other sons got. You remember the story of the prodigal son? And the prodigal son said, Father, give me the share of the inheritance that is due to me. So if you had two sons, he was the younger one. That means he was getting one third because the older son had two thirds. But that was the maximum that could be done. Moses, in the law of Moses, I believe God limited it to that. Because back in the day, and this time, in the time of Abraham and Isaac, the father could give basically the whole thing. Like you just saw Abraham, he just gave a couple of bank accounts, right, to these other guys and sent them away. So Jacob doesn't know. Jacob says, well, you know, my father might just drop the whole thing on Esau. It's his call. And I want to buy from him that right. So no matter what my father does, I have the right to take that from him. So having that birthright would also most likely mean that you had the leadership of the family as well. You were the leader of the tribe. And it might have also included the spiritual being the heir of the promises of God as well. So Moses wants you to know that although Jacob is definitely a terrible, conniving person in the story, Esau also is really a bad guy here, someone that we should never emulate. And he says he despised his birthright. How could you stand under such great blessing and just to get a full stomach for a few hours, trade away everything that God wanted to give you? And so really, you know, we are Christians and we are much more accustomed to the New Testament and understanding everything that God did in Jacob later on and so forth. We are accustomed to thinking about the treachery of Jacob and, you know, how he had to learn at a high cost how to walk more equitably with people. But the Jewish people have also focused a lot on the spiritual lesson to be learned from Esau and what a terrible thing it is to refuse and trade away the blessings of God for your immediate gratification. And so he is a very bad person. And he's referred to as an immoral person and a fornicator in the New Testament. So we can't exactly be sure how that would differ from the blessing that Isaac will pass on later that Jacob also wants, right? That was something also to be coveted. And we're going to talk about that story of trickery later on. That was a prophetic blessing that Isaac was able to give. But certainly here, this birthright was something that was valuable enough for Jacob to try to obtain however he could. And we have records from this part of the world going back this far that indicate to us that inheritances could be bought and sold among people. So this was something that could be done, right? For a temporary advantage today, you agree to sell me your inheritance when you get it. So there's nothing at all about this story that really could not literally have happened like that. So swear to me, maybe we're going to write it down in front of a witness or whatever. So there's obvious lessons here for us that I don't have to drill into, but the obvious lesson is that we need to value more than anything the inheritance that we have in Christ and never swap that away for the pleasures of sin or to indulge ourselves carnally. And in a more refined spiritual sense, right, value what God has given to us so that we can pass it on to the next generation. You may remember centuries later the story of Elijah and Jezebel, that Ahab and Jezebel conspired to take away a man's inheritance. The king went to this man called Naboth and said, "Give me your vineyard." And he's very highly complimented, I think, in Scripture. Because why? Because he refused. He said to the king, "God forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers, the thing that God has given me to pass on to my kids, and even to sell it to you at a price. Because this is something that was given to me by God that I am expected to pass on to the next generation. And I can't give it to you, king, at any price." What a different attitude, right, than the attitude of Esau, who just for the sake of his belly was willing to give up everything that God might have blessed him with. So a powerful story and a powerful warning there. Okay, any questions, anybody? I'm sorry, I didn't intend to go that long, but it's a long one. Yeah, and I wouldn't interpret that to mean literal hatred anyway. I mean, I would interpret that to mean being favored, right? Because, you know, God's choice, which he made known in prophecy, was clear apparently before they were born, which we're getting ahead of ourselves, but, you know, Paul talks about that in Romans, you know, that this was by the choice of God from their mother's womb that God had intended for Jacob to be the son of promise. How God would have probably have intended for that to happen better, in a better way than this, in a more honorable way than this, we don't know. and we'll never know, probably until we're in heaven, but he is certainly looked at as somebody that is viewed as profane, the Bible says, and immoral. He was and you see as he goes on, he's kind of like a somebody who brings grief to his parents. He marries into the Canaanites and all of that kind of thing. So he's not a good person, even though we always feel sorry for him. But he's not a good guy. He's a bad guy in the story. It's just that we focus most of the story on Jacob and Jacob's deceptions, which of course are also very distasteful to us. So both these guys were bad guys.
I once heard a sermon about, you know, the sins of the father being visited on the third and fourth generation. So when you see a character flaw in Abraham being deceptive, when he's out in Egypt saying that his wife is not really his wife, it's his sister, then you see that happening with Jacob, and then you see it happening with Jacob's kids. So it's just a continuation. So the connivingness, amongst that, you know, that generation.
Yeah, it's a powerful. It's a powerful dynamic, right, of generational sin. We're going to see in short order next week or the week after that, Isaac, out of fear, ends up doing the exact same thing Abraham did, the whole not really my wife routine, right?
Yeah.
So, and then, as you said, the deceptions and how all the brothers ended up deceiving their father. It's alarming. It's alarming. The only way to break that was to become, instead of deceiving each other, the way to break that, and I'm getting way ahead of us. We won't get here until Thanksgiving time. But I seriously mean that. But Judah acquires the character over time to become a sacrificial intercessor, and is willing to stay behind in Egypt. So that Benjamin does not have to remain a slave. And Judah's gradual growth, his spiritual growth, which culminated in that act, according to tradition, that's why Judah's line was chosen for the kingship. Because he developed that nobility of character that none of the rest of them had. Like Judah's the fourth son. He has no business having the kingship. But God gave him the rulership because he was the only one that developed an intercessory character. So, yeah. Daddy, hand up.
Regarding this carrying the sins of the father down a few generations, I never could comprehend that or accept it. We are born as children of Jesus with a free mind, a free will, to make our decisions.
Yeah.
How can I'm being pre-programmed by my father screwing up? How can that be allowed? That regardless how good I am, mm-hmm. how good I follow the precepts of the Lord, I'm still going to have that albatross.
Mm-hmm.
On my conscience or on my shoulders, what have you?
Yeah, great question. And I try to be very careful when we talk about this because I don't want to create the implication that God is punishing people that way, because we know that God had said to them later on, right, in Ezekiel, that every person is responsible and will be punished for their own sins, not the sins of their fathers. I think what we need to distinguish is that there is, I think, a generational weakness that people have. We see these dynamics in people's lives all the time. So, you know, people, I think, know that, for example, children of alcoholics very often can become alcoholics themselves. And it's not necessarily because there's something that went through their blood, but it's because it's patterns of behavior, learned behavior, the way that people do things, the power of that example. And if those areas are not submitted to the Lord, we're going to end up doing the very same things that our parents did, and we're going to end up doing the things that we swore we would never do that our parents did. So it's just interesting that there does seem to be this root of deceptive behavior that keeps cropping up in this family over and over again out of fear. So, you know, Abraham did that lie about his wife twice. Isaac did the same thing, and they were always deceiving each other. So I don't at all interpret, because, you know, when we come to faith in Christ, we're born again.
Yes.
But then we also have, as you say, you know, we have the choice of our own actions. The problem is sometimes that we don't know properly how to think. You know, our mind is not renewed, so we end up following our examples. We end up succumbing to our atmosphere, and we end up many times doing the same thing that our forefathers did. So I absolutely agree with you, but I do think that there is a dynamic there in which we end up becoming our parents without wanting to, because we imitate them when it's easier to knuckle under to those temptations in a weak moment, which we will see that Isaac did. When Isaac fell into that weakness of fear, traveling in the country of the Philistines, he ended up doing exactly the same thing that his father had did and telling the exact same kind of lie. So that just tells me that he picked it up from somewhere. He is just as responsible for that sin as Abraham was for that sin as well. There's a sin in both of them. So I hope that's helpful, but that is an area I think I agree with where you're coming from, because that is an area where we have to be careful about how we phrase those things and talk about those things, because we don't want to imply something that the Bible definitely does not teach. So, anybody else?
Yes.
Yeah, Maria? Oh, sorry.
I was just thinking about when you were talking about the character of God, and you were mentioning how he, you know, he blesses Abraham to have his son for his own purposes, but then it's like, I think the character of God is more that, you know, after that, he has this whole new family. You know, in other words, it's not just like, I did this one miracle, and now we're good. You know, in other words, it's like, I changed you completely, and now even giving you this ability to bless you even more any way that you like. You know, like, you're you. Now I'm not saying it very well, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To bless him more so. I think that, you know, the converse almost speaks so much more to how God thinks about us and wants to bless us. Not, I think that's a, you know, that kind
right.
of...
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it does. It talks about visiting the iniquity to the third and fourth generation. When it talks about blessing, it says to 1,000 generations, which is far more powerful, right? So those things, call them what you want, those things can all be cut off and stopped and turned around through the power of Christ. So, Sasha.
I didn't know Abraham was married so many times, but it does make sense that in order to create a nation, you got to have a lot of people giving birth, you know?
It helps.
Yeah, so, but, and I'm sure, you know, him and his wife, they were all anointed through God. When did it come to a time where God said, okay, we're not going to be Mormons anymore. We're going to stop this, and we're going to, like, only have one monogamous relationship because there's enough people on the earth now. We don't need to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a great question, and the answer is that God has never said that. So, you know, God has never told the nations not to have more than one wife. So that doesn't mean that he approves of it. You can go back when we were first starting the class, and we were talking about the fact that everywhere that you see polygamy in the Bible, it's always a negative. And then when you see Jacob, you know, with his four wives, and that household was just a mess. But God has never prohibited that, you know, for his own reasons. You know, he's never prohibited that. But in the Christian gospel, people who are called to be overseers are only allowed to have one wife. And the reason is that, you know, as overseers in God's house, pastors, elders, whatever, you know, we have to reflect the true picture of what marriage is supposed to be. Marriage is supposed to be reflective of the union between Christ and his church. And so polygamy is something that is tolerated, if you want to use that word, by God. But even in the Torah, God didn't, you know, command. He only told the kings not to multiply wives to themselves. right? But he never said you couldn't have more than one wife. But everywhere you look in there, anytime polygamy was engaged in, it was always negative for all the obvious reasons. There's, it's impossible not to mistreat a woman within the meaning of what marriage is supposed to be if you have more than one wife. You know, there's kids, obviously, that are going to be neglected. There's going to be a favorite wife. There's going to be some favorite kids. It's unavoidable. Yeah. It's just human nature.
Adultery in the Bible still is like legal grounds to actually let go of a marriage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So all of those jealousies and then the whole system of concubines. So it's crazy. So it's like an insult for each other to say, well, you're the son of a maid. You're not even on my level, right? Because Jacob had two wives and he had two concubines. So there's a pecking order of the sons. It's like, well, there's sons of wives, and then there's sons of maids, and you guys are just sons of maids. So, you know, you're not, you don't have my status. And so it's just a mess. It breeds nothing but conflict in the human family. And I think religions that do allow that, like Mormonism and Islam, only do that for the purposes of gratification.
And trailer parks.
Hang on, guys. I can't hear Jack.
Yeah.
Well, if he was married to them, right? Because just the practice was that they could take multiple wives or as many as they could afford. So, you know. When you read that about Solomon, he had, between wives and concubines, he literally had 1,000, which may just be a round number, but the idea was that basically he had so many, probably couldn't keep track of them, and, you know, nothing but grief came out of that, and they pulled his heart away into idolatry. So there again is another example of where God says this is just the dumbest of dumb ideas.
When Jesus taught on divorce, didn't he imply that it was one
right.
man and one woman?
Because right.
asked him about divorce.
Yep.
He kind of
yep.
cleared that up too.
Yep. The two shall become one flesh. Mm-hmm. Right. But I mean, to Sasha's narrow question, it was it was never prohibited in the sense of saying thou shalt only have one wife, but it's always a negative, and I think we can all, and you're definitely in a few chapters, you're definitely going to see why in Jacob's story. But.
Wasn't it like that?
Right.
We just went outside of
right. And the first right. And the first person
I don't think he was pleased with it.
No, but he allowed it for whatever reason. I don't know if it was so to propagate the species, but from the very beginning, the very first guy that did it, there's a notation of it that he took these two wives. He was the one who was boastful, revenging Lamech, saying that, you know, he had killed a man just for hurting him. And so forth. So he's, when you see that first instance of something in the scripture, it tells you the character of something, right? So he was boastful, he was arrogant, obnoxious, violent. So God is trying to stamp polygamy for us right away as being something dysfunctional, something that just enables men to indulge their lusts. And it actually creates poverty in a society. You know, two cannot live as cheaply as one. And, you know, 50 cannot live as cheaply as two. So.
It basically just sounds to me like it's like a way for men to just like, you know, have.
Indulge themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that's exactly right.
You're my concubine. Well, you're pretty, so you're my third wife. You're my fourth wife.
You're exactly
it's a
right.
way to like, I mean, I don't know why.
Well, but that's exactly what I was saying. And I just made a comment about Mormonism and Islam. I think that those things are designed to promote unrighteousness, to put a religious okay upon a form of living that is really not godly and that doesn't reflect God's ideal for marriage. So it's just, you know, it's all over the world even today. And what the church did in the days of the early church, and even today, missionaries, to avoid problems of divorce and poverty, missionaries typically do not tell people to break their polygamous marriages. But they would only take Christian leadership from people who only have one wife. Because that's what Paul said that we should do. He said a bishop has to be the husband of one wife. So if you have more than one wife, you are disqualified from Christian leadership. But that's the only technical prohibition on it in the Bible. So it's always been illegal, at least for probably 1,500 years in countries that were affected by Christianity because of the very bad influence of it. So, yeah.
In relation to the valuing the inheritance, in the Book of Ruth, when the near kinsman refused to marry Ruth because he didn't want to mar his inheritance, was he valuing it or was he disobeying the law?
Well, it was his option to do that. But it was viewed as not charitable, as not an honorable thing to do. That's another form of marriage that would not fly in our society, you know. So, you know, if, having to marry your brother-in-law if your husband died and things like that. So that was viewed as a shameful thing because by doing that and by being with Ruth, those children would be considered to be the children of the deceased. And you're supposed to take care of your family by, in that situation, raising up kids for your brother so that your brother's name is not wiped out. Very strange custom to us, but God's trying to teach us how important that inheritance is. I didn't mention it when I was talking about Naboth and his vineyard, but you have to remember that the way that the land of Israel was parceled out, all of that property came to them by lot. Right? So they divided up the land. God said, okay, this is the territory of this tribe. But then the land of that tribe was divided by casting lots. So, okay, this piece is for Jalinda, and this piece is for Nate, this piece is for Iris, right? And so on down the line, and we chop it up. So in a very literal sense, every single Israelite that owned land could say, I have been literally given this land by the sovereign choice of God. And that's why they were so attached to it, and God was teaching them through that means and through the what they called the Levirate marriage that you're talking about, how important it was that everybody's name should continue and that everybody should always keep what God had given to them for an eternal possession. It's a very powerful concept, you know. We just are not attached to anything. But they were very attached to the land because the land is an really an indissoluble part of who they are as a people. That they are a people, yes, but they are living on a land that even a slice of land, your individual plot, was literally given to you by the creator of the universe. And that's a very powerful concept that you can't just easily tear out of somebody's thinking. So, that's why Esau, even though Jacob is a bad guy in the story, Esau is also looked at as a despicable person who was totally lacking in appreciation for spiritual things. So the Jewish people, the way that they read these things, too symbolically, my opinion of course, but too symbolically, they always say that all the way down to the end of time, until the time of Messiah, that Israel will always have two enemies, Edom and Ishmael. So to them, Ishmael would represent Islam, Arabs and Islam, and Edom is Westerners. So forth, Christianity. So they say that the children of Edom, you know, are fornicators, they're sensual, they don't have an appreciation of spiritual things, and the people of Ishmael are violent, bloodthirsty, and so forth. So they've got these two opposing poles, they say, that are always our enemies, Edom and... And if you read what some of these folks say, if you ever read any of that literature, they would refer to us as Edom. It's very interesting. So That's how they view our type of society, that we are represented by the base and sensual type of a person like Esau. So.
And just a quick PS, on April 22nd last year is when we started this, the first session.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to finish around Christmas time, by the way. So I hope you're going to hang back with me through all the way through the fall. So.
Yeah. One quick question on this present. Getting back to the original part of the do we know what approximate age she was? No idea.
It's interesting because you can read up on all these people, but it's all legendary. You know, we have no idea. It's all legendary stuff. Thanks, guys.
Have a good night.